Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, my pals. This is going to be a quick enough intro. I am sick as a dog. I don't know what is wrong with me. I have a violent head cold. A head cold, I just would like to say, is not something that would normally take me down. I'm very tough, but this one is really doing a number on me. I'm sorry that this is a day late. Poor Carl had a stomach bug yesterday, so it was just like the universe was saying, you simply cannot do this today. Fortunately, we are here today for you with the news, and there was so much to talk about, from the referendums to the American State of the Union address to what's going on in Gaza, to some new rape statistics in Ireland, and also potential legislation on assisted dying, and then also we talk about the legislation for licensing laws, which will lead to later opening hours in pubs and nightclubs. All very important stuff, and I really hope you enjoy. Hello, Carl Kunzler. Thank you for rising from your sickbed to speak to me today. We are a day late, guys, as you have noticed. I'm sick, Carl's sick, we're all sick.
Yeah, we're soldiering through, though. We're being very brave about it.
We're so brave, Carl. We're so brave.
I know. I can only imagine how much the listeners must be admiring us right now. Those two are troopers.
Yeah, they're like, I wish I had their address because I would send them a gift. Such is their resilience. Yeah. Actually, everyone I had a couple of meetings yesterday that I couldn't reschedule. And everyone I spoke to said that there's like loads of stuff going around at the moment. So apparently there are lots of sick people. So I'm sure there are lots of people who are listening from their sick beds or who are also sick at the moment, who you have our sympathies. You are very brave soldiering on in this life. And frankly, even if you're not sick, you're very brave soldiering on in this life.
We're all in this together, guys.
Okay, well, let's get stuck in because, you know, this is the thing. It is a very busy news week. We, of course, have to talk about the referendums. The subheading I put in our email was referendum disaster, and it was a disaster for the government.
It was. It was, you know, an absolute landslide failure in both referendums. I think, obviously, the support across even mainstream political parties for the care referendum had kind of collapsed in the last week. And I think a lot of people had begun to anticipate a no vote in the care referendum. I think people at large were not really anticipating a no vote in the family referendum.
No.
I think that one had started to sort of fly under the radar. It was certainly less discussed. Mm. But in the end, both of them were absolutely trounced. You know, more than 70% of people voted against both of them. And, you know, people did talk about a low turnout. But the turnout, you know, we've certainly had much lower turnouts, you know. Mm. So ultimately, you know, I think Leo Varadkar himself, you know, said that it was a significant enough turnout that the government sort of accepted that, you know, it had been beaten. And I think he described it as receiving two wallops, which is an interesting phrase. Mm. But now we can see in the aftermath now, in the days that have come, the government, and they are scrambling. You know, and TDs from government parties are really scrambling. I saw yesterday Willie O'Dea and James O'Connor from Fianna Fáil talking about the need to sort of get rid, you know, get back to basics and stop playing to the woke gallery. And it's just, I feel like we're about to enter a very, very stupid new phase of Irish politics.
Well, it's very strange for Willie O'Dea to be talking about the woke gallery or the woke army or whoever, when there are other people who say that it's the far right who have succeeded in defeating these referendums. So, like, you know, who, like, you know, it seems like you lost on all sides.
It's really interesting because, as you say, yeah, like I feel like the no vote comes from so many different cohorts. Mm. You know, you have people, you know, you've seen the kind of the misinformation side of things where people were putting up posters about like the, no specifics at all, but, you know, quote unquote consequences for immigration. But then you have people who are also voting no because they, you know, they believed very sincerely, and it may have turned out to be the case that, you know, these referendums would have basically let the state off the hook for, you know, providing care.
Yeah.
So you kind of have both ends of the spectrum, people rejecting, you know, the wording of the referendums. And ultimately what it comes down to, and this has been spoken about a lot in the last couple of days, is that, you know, in 2015 for the same-sex referendum and in 2018 for the repeal referendum, you know, there was an enormous grassroots campaign that had been going back years and years and years. Mm. And I think that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, they started to, well, Fine Gael more so, they started to believe their own hype that they were the ones who had succeeded in those referendums, that they were the ones who led the campaign, and that they were the ones who had sort of convinced people, which that was never the case.
Yeah, you know, it was grassroots activists.
And there was no sort of time for grassroots activists to sort of get together on this one. The wording was very unclear. Obviously, they didn't go with the care referendum. They didn't go with the Citizens Assembly recommendation of the state being obliged to provide care. So, you know, this is a thing where it really falls in the government's lap, I think. You know, that's sort of my diagnosis of it.
Yeah.
They weren't clear, they weren't credible, it wasn't a strong campaign, you know. There was no organization. So people
weren't happy with the wording. I mean, I think at the end of the day that can't be denied. Like, I think there were lots of people who in theory definitely want the family redefined and definitely want to see gendered language removed from the constitution, but weren't happy with the wording. And, you know, I think they kind of fucked it from the get-go, pardon my French. The misinformation is really something else, though. I was in a taxi on whatever day we voted, Friday, of course, International Women's Day, which, by the way, like, I saw so many women talking about this over the course of Friday, saying that, you know, what a cute move by the government. We'll do it on International Mother's Day. The women will love it. But what that actually means is that schools were closed for International Women's Day. And lots of the time, the reorganization and the arrangements and the babysitting and all the rest is something that has to be done by women. So thanks for that. But I was in a taxi on my way to an event that day, and my taxi driver said, I think there's a lot of misinformation around about the referendums. And I said, yeah. And then he said, I had a woman in the taxi yesterday who told me that if we voted yes, there would be no mention of the word mother in people's birth certificates anymore. It would be removed from everyone's birth certificates. And I was like, what? I was like, that is not true. And he said, I didn't think it was true. He said, and I said it to her and she was so certain about it. She'd seen it on a Facebook group and she was completely convinced that that was the case. Like, that's, we know that disinformation is a massive problem. We know that Facebook is a massive problem, frankly. But, you know, there really is a huge problem there. If the government want to ever get a referendum across the line, they're going to have to really, really commit to doing something about misinformation, because it's crazy.
Absolutely. And particularly with the social media companies, because the big issue there is it's so insidious, because we don't know even what misinformation people are hearing, because everybody is being served different sort of things through their algorithm. We don't know what groups people are a part of. So instead of kind of having these open discussions like we used to have, where everybody is at least, you know, not singing from the same hymn sheet, but we're all working with the same information. You know, we all are making our decisions based on the same facts. Mm. Whereas in this case, you have people making decisions based on completely different, it's like they're living in different realities. A really strange thing I wanted to note that I saw this morning, that Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers, who's running for European Parliament, she went on the radio and she talked about how she voted no. And how, you know, it's important, again, it's kind of the same line of Fianna Fáil needing to get back to the old fundamentals. But 2 weeks ago she was campaigning for yes.
Yeah,
you know. You know, and she claimed then that she was a bit wishy-washy. She said that she had never took part in a debate.
Yeah, but she'd been handing out leaflets. Yeah. So, like, and, you know, let's not get into the semantics of it.
Yeah, and it's the absolute distillation of that phrase of, like, you know, you know, victory has 1,000 fathers, but, you know, defeat is an orphan. Mm. And they've all just kind of, like, Ivana Bacik. And to be fair to Ivana Bacik, she was originally critical of the wording, but she did ultimately campaign for yes, yes, and call for yes, yes. But once it had failed, you know, she was saying, no, this was a bad idea. We didn't do this well, all that kind of thing. And it's like, well, you could have spoken up in a more emphatic way. You could have, you know, and you have Sinn Féin have said now, Matt Carthy said today that they won't rerun the referendum in any way, shape or form. Mm. So, and it's like, you know, so we are just kind of stuck with this unbelievably ridiculous reference to women in the home in our constitution for probably the foreseeable.
That decision that, like, we're not going to do it again. Like, that seems so, that's so frustrating, I think, when you consider the general feeling of the Irish population. Like, I saw a law professor saying over the weekend that he has been, you know, lecturing students for decades, and they have always been in agreement that nobody was happy with the wording of these clauses of the Constitution and that everybody wanted them changed. So the fact that it got defeated so roundly, it really says something about the approach, you know, that I don't believe, and I know I don't think you believe, and I don't think many people believe, that people are really committed to the idea of, you know, the role of women being in the Constitution in the way that it is now. But, like, it just, the wording wasn't good enough. And so to just say, well, we're not going to do it again is kind of sickening. But, like, also, you can kind of understand it, because €22 million was spent on this referendum, if I have that right. Like, it's a huge amount of money to not do something properly and end up wasting.
It's a huge amount of money. And ultimately, in terms of sort of the democratic side of things and rerunning a referendum, the referendums were, they were crushed, you know? Yeah. Like, if it was 51-49, you know, you kind of, you immediately have a mandate to say, oh, we should run this again. Mm. You know, 73-27, it's much harder to justify.
I suppose, yeah.
And that's not me saying at all that I wouldn't, you know, like, I absolutely think that the Constitution needs to be updated. It's so antiquated. But it's very hard to justify because, and this for me, as I said earlier, it falls in the lap of the government, you know?
Yeah.
Oftentimes you do only get one chance to do these things because, as you say, you can't just keep rerunning things until it's, you kind of get what you want. Mm. But, like, that's, and for me, that it's such a damning indictment of how the, and, like, we talk about how Leo Varadkar's appearance on the 6 o'clock show and him giving his take about, you know, he doesn't believe this, it should be the responsibility of the state. I think the whole thing left such a bad taste in everyone's mouths. Something my mother always used to say when I was younger was that when people, you know, if you don't necessarily know what's going on in a referendum, just vote no to be safe.
Yeah.
That was something that was the kind of the wisdom. I think a lot of Irish people do adhere to that.
Yeah.
And I think if the government leave this enormous vacuum of information, then you are going to increase the no vote enormously because, you know, it's a lot of referendums, you listen to your heart, you know, repeal, you listen to your heart, same-sex marriage, you listen to your heart. Referendum like this, you kind of need to listen to barristers, you know, qualified barristers. Yeah. And then you also need to listen to the stakeholders as well. But it's just much more difficult for people.
Yeah.
And I think the government did not do enough bringing the information to the fore. And yeah, it's, you know, we talk about the family referendum. 40% of children in Ireland are born out of wedlock. So there's enormous kind of non-traditional family setups in Ireland.
Mm.
And yet we have just voted in huge numbers to keep this very, very old fangled definition of family. So it doesn't seem to line up with Irish people and what they want. And I blame the government for there not being enough information about the referendums.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can blame anyone else really, to be honest. But I mean, at the same time, no, look, sure, look, we'll park it. Let's move on to Gaza, where things trundle on, unfortunately. The conflict is no closer to being over. Although I suppose it does feel like we've seen a slight turn in the Americans over the course of the last week.
Yeah, so they've obviously begun to sort of build this port, and they're trying to send aid more directly, and they're sending aid from the sky with the sky drops. And it's, you know, obviously, this means more aid will get in, certainly. Some people, there's reports of people being killed by the aid drops, you know, 5 people killed by the aid drops. And a lot of people are framing it as, you know, the United States, they are building this port to get the aid in. But what this also does just mean is American boots on the ground. You know, what a lot of people see it as is kind of American occupation of Gaza. And I think people are very wary of it because of the role America has played so far.
But also, I read that it would take like 2 months for that to be finished. So like, that's too late for people who are literally starving now.
That's right. And because, I mean, it's too late today, you know, it's too late today. So 2 months from now,
yeah.
It's but like you say though, it is a shift. And there's a big turn up for the books this morning as well of Ursula von der Leyen. She was saying that you know, we've kind of reached an inflection point and that the Cyprus maritime corridor needs to be used to get aid into Gaza. Mm. And you know, if people don't know, Ursula von der Leyen has really been the most staunch defender of that's the president of the European Commission. Mm. She's been the most, from the very get-go, she was kind of very staunch about Israel's right to defend itself, and she really wasn't accepting of kind of any other view. Mm. So the fact that even she now is talking about getting aid into Gaza, it just goes to show. And you know, Reuters this week said we crossed 30,000 deaths, 25,000 of those are women and children. So I mean, even the most and I really do think Ursula von der Leyen and of course Joe Biden, these are two people who are really staunch defenders of Israel. Mm. If you've got these people now even fighting to get aid into Gaza, and you know, we Joe Biden this week was kind of caught on a hot mic saying that Netanyahu needed to have a come to Jesus moment or a come to Jesus meeting, which is a weird phrase that Americans mm. use when they want someone to change their mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, you know, I don't think there's any hope of Netanyahu has been very, very clear that he's not Joe Biden's lapdog by any stretch. He's not going to be brought to heel. So
surely the only way for the Americans to do something about what's happening is to stop giving them or selling them weapons.
Yeah, like, turn the faucet off. And
that's why all of this talk is kind of like very frustrating, because it's like, okay, yeah, you can talk about sending aid, but like at the same time, if you're still sending weapons to Israel, then like, what's the point? Like, it's just, see, it feels like posturing.
Yeah, and I think for people kind of reading it, it feels just like cognitive dissonance, you know, because yeah. and especially because in Ireland, I think, you know, years back, there was definitely and I do think actually globally, you know, Joe Biden is quite a popular figure. He was thought of as very kind of nice, everybody's grandfather, kind of uncle-y kind of vibes. And I think people had always wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think so when he comes out and he, you know, talks about airdropping aid and building this pier, people do want to come around and do a 180 and be like, look, Joe Biden is trying. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that like that is just unfortunately the most naive position we could take, because you know, he is the one who, like he has said a million times about that he is a staunch Zionist, and he is happily selling these weapons, you know, kind of under no conditions whatsoever. They say there are these conditions of, you know, adhering to human rights law, but I mean, as we see, there are, and I mean, the famine now at this point, it seems like it is hunger that's killing people in Gaza yeah. as much as the bombs, you know, and we're seeing horrible images of starved children, you know, and it's you know, it's that's where we are, you know, as of
now. There's no more words to use. Like, we've talked about it now so much. There's no more. It's horrifying. It's awful. It's heartbreaking. It's soul destroying. It's a living nightmare. It's all of those things. Like, what do you say? It's I literally cannot believe that it is carrying on.
And so you got an enormous response, obviously, to your International Women's Day and Mother's Day post on Instagram. I saw that was, I mean, and that goes to show the level to which it resonates. You know, like kind of on Mother's Day, people are not thinking of themselves anymore. They're not thinking of the breakfast in bed. They are preoccupied with this horror.
Yeah, for anyone who didn't see it, I just posted it. I just was really feeling it so deeply that like I'm sitting there in my house with my kids and my Mother's Day card, and all I had in my head was all the women we've seen holding their dead children and all the traumatized children we've seen whose mothers have been killed in front of them often. And, you know, all of the mothers and children who have been impacted. And as we say, it is in the tens of thousands now. It's so difficult to sit in your happy little life and, you know, celebrate mothers and ignore the fact that mother after mother after mother has been brutally killed in this conflict, for want of a better term. I mean, the thing is, it's unacceptable, and yet it's what we're being forced to accept. So it's a very difficult time to be alive if you're someone who feels these things, and to feel powerless. And I know that there's lots of efforts being made around this country to raise money. I know that there are people who are taking, you know, really difficult stances, like, for example, all of the acts who've pulled out of South by Southwest, all the Irish acts who have, you know, that's a huge sacrifice for them, you know, in terms of both exposure. And they've all spent loads of money to go, and now they won't make any money out of it. You know, there are lots of people who are doing what they can. And I think that's what we just have to continue to do. And actually, speaking of that, I did see that there was a discussion about Ireland's contribution to aid being delivered to Gaza as well this week in the Dáil.
Yes, and that will be taking place. We'll be, unfortunately, we don't have, as part of our military, we don't have heavy airlifters. Mm. So not the kind of thing we can do ourselves. But in conjunction with the Kingdom of Jordan, which is kind of, Jordan is a, you know, a country in the Middle East that sort of oftentimes is used sort of as a back channel into countries that are like, Jordan would be an ally of the Western countries. So that's the means by which we're going to get the aid in. And yeah, it's, I mean, as you say, it kind of, it does fall into the category of, you know, it is, it's late in the game. But I mean, famine is the, you know, earlier on kind of bombing was the issue. Right now, famine is the issue. So you can kind of see the logic of why the aid is being dropped now.
Yeah.
Certainly there was, you know, call for aid for the last, you know, 6 months. But I mean, it's still, it's, to call it a positive, you know, it's kind of weird. You almost have to reassess how you use language, because it's like, it's not a positive thing. I suppose it's a mitigating thing. It mitigates how awful this is. But I mean, that's really all. There was obviously the statement from Michael D. Higgins this week as well, calling for a permanent ceasefire, which is very strong. I don't know. I don't want to horn in on the entertainment podcast, but the speech from Jonathan Glazer at the Oscars, I thought was extremely impressive, very affecting. And, you know, it was sad that there weren't more. Kind of Mark Ruffalo on the red carpet was very good. Swan Arlo from Anatomy of a Fall also.
Yeah, Rami Yusuf as well.
Yes, Rami Yusuf.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to, I mean, not as hard as it is to be in Gaza, obviously, but it is difficult to kind of have everything happening at the same time. Joe Biden, though, had a good week, it has to be said, because he delivered his State of the Union address, which is an annual presidential speech that is made. It's long, it's like an hour long, and he was seen to really succeed in the speech.
It's sort of, you know, it's kind of almost the, on an annual sense, it's kind of the most important thing, or certainly the most public thing a president does every year. You know, it goes before the two houses of Congress and gives it, yeah, as you say, a State of the Union. And it is long, and I think Joe Biden benefits a little bit from the lowered expectations, because he, you know, kind of comes across as doddery a lot of the time, and sort of not necessarily in total command of himself. So, yeah, when he kind of stands up and gives an hour and a half long speech, yeah, people are certainly impressed. There were sort of, you know, good and bad elements to it. He was very, I would say he was very Joe Biden-y in terms of what his concerns were. You know, kind of, he sort of let a lot about Ukraine, you know, and this again gets back to the strange cognitive dissonance in America, is the kind of the absolute emphatic need, like, they are kind of obsessed with getting aid to Ukraine. And by all means, you know, aid to Ukraine, that's not me saying that there shouldn't be aid sent to Ukraine, by all means. But it's just that they ignore the parallels with the same kind of invading force or the same sort of occupational aggressive stance that Israel has towards Gaza, that kind of Russia has towards Ukraine. He was strong on guns. He brought a guest, a survivor of the Uvalde shooting. So he had like a few highlights. He had a weird moment where he kind of got into a back and forth with Marjorie Taylor Greene, the sort of very controversial MAGA congresswoman, and he did use a weird phrase. He was talking about a woman who had been killed by someone who had illegally migrated to the US, and he said, you know, they were killed by an illegal, and I think, you know, that it's a weird way to talk about people. Again, Joe Biden is sometimes is sort of, you know, people make excuses for him, because he's sort of as we say, like, he's not a very precise speaker. But yeah, that whole kill, so, but he certainly did a lot better than Katie Britt, who is the Republican. So this is another thing about the State of the Union. So when the State of the Union happens, then the party that's not in power, in this case the Republicans, they do a sort of a response State of the Union. And at that time, this responsibility fell to 42-year-old Alabama Senator Katie Britt. And I really recommend watching the video. Maybe don't watch the whole video, but like, if you can find the highlights. Because she's like something out of, I saw lots of different descriptions. I think one of the best ones was like something out of a Lifetime movie.
Yeah.
And her delivery on, so she's, you know, she's talking about very serious things, but her voice is at times quivering. At times she's on the cusp of laughing hysterically. She's sitting in her kitchen throughout it, which is bizarre. Yeah.
So the kitchen setting is already, you're like a woman in a kitchen. Seriously, yeah. Republicans?
She could be behind a podium.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Crazy. But then the second thing is, Yeah, it's just like, I mean, theatrical kind of doesn't really cover it. It was like a secondary school student in a play, like, you know, really overdoing every emotion. But there were even, you know, it turned out inaccuracies in what she actually had to say. So aside from her performance, what she had to say wasn't great.
Yeah, and she was giving examples for, and again, migration is such an issue in the US at the minute, but she was giving examples of sort of episodes of violence resulting, or not resulting from, but like violence committed by, you know, illegal immigrants. But she was giving examples from decades ago.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was just, it didn't, you know.
But also the example that she gave was from decades ago. So she said, she was like, I was in Rio Grande, Texas, and I met a young woman who shared her story with me. And guys, that is not far off the actual delivery, by the way. I'm not good at impressions, but that's the tone. And she shared her story with me of being trafficked by the cartels. And like, it turns out she was trafficked by the cartels, but she was trafficked by the cartels in Mexico. And it was during George Bush's presidency. So like, all this just, yeah, it was very bad. It was so bad that even the Republican commentators said it was bad.
Yeah, they all hated it. And my favorite bit was, she was talking about Joe Biden's executive orders on immigration. And she said, and that is breathtaking. And she like, she then acted out. Breathtaking. And it's just like, what are you? And it's funny because there's actually like a history of these speeches being awful. Like Marco Rubio, who used to be like the great shining light of the Republican Party, and like Trump beat him in the primaries in 2016, he gave the response State of the Union, I think 2015, 2016. And he is drinking from a little tiny cup of water throughout it. And his hands are like shaking. And it's just something about, I think they should probably just give up on the response State of the Union entirely, because. Yeah. And it is funny, Katie Britt, like, she's meant to be kind of a rising star in the Republican Party. I think this is going to knock her back, you know, way back.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, the thing is, there will have been loads of other people involved in that speech, like in writing it, in, you know, deciding that it was in her kitchen. Like, it wouldn't just be her, but it is going to be her whose reputation is going to be banjaxed.
Although I did see one tweet from a guy called Radio Free Tom, who's sort of like he's a nuclear expert, but he's a kind of a US politics commentator. He's quite strong. And he was saying that the way he saw it was, though it may seem ridiculous to so many people, it will actually really appeal to a lot of MAGA voters who love the drama. And they look, because I mean, Trump is kind of similar, like it's all the pageantry and the very strong expression. So I mean, it's that kind of thing where you look at it, you and I can look at it and be like, my God, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then maybe, you know, her base in Alabama, they could absolutely love it. So.
Well, I did think that myself, because if you ever watch any of the kind of reporters who go to MAGA gatherings or whatever and speak to interview people, you know, frequently the people they interview, I mean, really don't know what they're talking about. And like, I don't just mean like they've been fed misinformation. I mean, like they'll say something and then there'll be a follow-up question and they have no way of backing it up. Like they seem to really take things at face value. So I think you're right.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so the committee that was looking at assisted dying in Ireland has made recommendations, and they are recommending legislation for assisted dying. I think some people will be surprised by this.
Yeah, this is something. So the Oireachtas Committee, they've recommended to allow for assisted, to legislate for assisted dying in very, very specific situations. So this is for people between 6 and 12 months to live. And it is very strict. So it's an incurable, irreversible, advanced and progressive illness that will cause death within 6 to 12 months. So that would be the category for eligibility for this. This is something that People Before Profit TD Gino Kenny has been fighting for a very long time. He's also a very strong campaigner on like medical marijuana, and he's someone who is his wheelhouse is sort of pain alleviation for people who are suffering from, as we say, irreversible, incurable, very painful illnesses. And we've also had, this is the kind of thing that Vicky Phelan also would have been, hugely in favor of. It's the kind of thing that I think in Ireland we've had a lot of high profile activists who have kind of been in support of this. And I actually think that in the global context, we have actually been quite prompt in dealing with it. This bill was tabled at first in 2020. It's 2024 now. Obviously, to a lot of people, that will sound like a really long time. These things do move slowly. And particularly when you're talking about what is literally a life and death situation. Mm. But Gino Kenny, who kind of I would consider to be the sort of leading voice on this right now, he said that he was very happy with the outcome. He said the committee was very thorough. And in his own words, he said it heard from all the vested interests in relation to the issue, from people opposed to assisted dying, those who are neutral and those who are supportive of it. So it sounds like the committee got a very good overview. Mm-hmm. They've made their decision now. So it's people with 6 to 12 months to live with very serious conditions. And like I say, I think this will be welcomed by a lot of activists and a lot of people who are stakeholders in those situations.
Well, I think that a lot of your average person who has ever had to kind of watch someone die slowly with a condition like that will probably be very happy about it as well, because there is it is excruciating both for the person and for everyone who loves them. Okay, now, licensing laws. My God, I feel like this is dragging on like you would not believe. We were all so excited to hear that the licensing laws were changing. They were correctly, in my view, allowing nightclubs to stay open until 6 a.m., allowing pubs to stay open until 12:30 so that everybody wouldn't be leaving everywhere at the same time. It all made perfect sense, and it still hasn't happened, and it's still probably not going to happen before the summer.
Yeah, probably not going to happen before the summer. This is something that I think when they first... So this is something that was first introduced in 2019. We just talked about things moving very slowly.
Yeah.
But it was in 2022, I believe, when it was first earmarked to be implemented. Their first intention, I think, was either late 2022 or spring 2023 was when they were hoping to actually get this, done.
Happening,
and,
yeah.
Happening, like literally happening in the world, not just talk. But no, we're not there yet. So Leo Varadkar announced this week that he cast doubt, as it were, on whether or not this would even be implemented by summer 2024. Mm. And this is like, it's kind of this, people like Sunil Sharp, is it Take Back the City or Take Back the Night?
Take Back the Night, I think, yeah.
He's someone who...
Reclaim
the Night.
I think so.
It's something,
Give us the night.
Yeah.
I think you were right in the first place. Sorry.
This is something that is so called for. Ireland, and this is something that Leo Varadkar even acknowledged when he was talking about it. He said that, Ireland or Dublin and Ireland cities, they're not on a par with Bucharest even, or London or Paris or Berlin. Like, we have no nighttime economy. It's crazy how little of a nighttime economy we have. It's such an outlier in kind of context of global cities. And the fact that it keeps getting kicked down, the can keeps getting kicked down the road, I think is really frustrating for anyone who is like a kind of a stakeholder in terms of a club owner or, someone who makes their money that way. But it's also very frustrating just for, I want to say young people, but everybody enjoys nightlife, to some extent. Everybody has a day, in the year where they want to be out until 1 or 2 or later, and when, like, it's just And it's funny, like Leo Varadkar said that he's pressing Helen McEntee, Minister for Justice, to like make move, but that she has a lot of priorities, which, you know, I accept.
Yeah, but his, the implication in what he said was like, you know, there's other stuff that's more important than this, actually, which I thought, yeah, he said, as Minister McEntee points out, she has many priorities and more important priorities than opening nightclubs late, perhaps, but she is working on it. Like, fuck off, Leo. Like, this is...
Honestly,
that's so patronizing and insulting to the people who have campaigned for this for years, for good reason. We have seen venue after venue close in Dublin and around the country. And, you know, that will just continue to happen until this is introduced, because it's not financially viable for nightclubs to be open for the few hours that they're currently allowed to be open. So it's not just, you know, we want to party. That is part of it. But like, you know, you're talking about businesses and business owners as well.
Yeah, like, you know, and I don't really think, you know, you have to have more kind of trust in the Irish people. Like, it's not about getting pissed and having a crazy time. Like, it is about kind of bringing Ireland's nighttime economy in line with what a modern, you know, globalized, you know, million plus population city should offer.
Yeah.
Particularly when you talk about like the enormous rents in Dublin, just the sort of difficulty of existing in Dublin. Yeah. There needs to be, and like, you know, and it's not just opening hours. This will, the reforming of the licensing laws will allow cultural spaces to, you know, sell alcohol, for example.
Yeah.
You know, which is, that is really important. It's important that we have like art spaces that can open until 12 and offer people like a full experience and that kind of thing. You know, other cities have these things. Other cities have, and you know, and it's just I don't know when this will be implemented, you know, because you talk about it's probably not going to be this summer. We're going to be heading bang into an election. You know, the latest we can have an election is February of 2025, which is less than a year away.
Yeah.
You know, if we get a new government, they are kind of under no mandate to implement it.
Yeah.
So it, the whole thing has just been a bit of a farce and a joke. And what I hate about it is that I think that the government has used the promise of it as leverage and then not delivered on it.
Yeah.
And that's what I find so kind of galling is that you have them sort of framing themselves as progressive, bringing in this night, like we're doing this for sort of young people, doing this for the nighttime economy, but then they don't actually do it, you know? I noticed you swore earlier on. I don't think I've ever sworn on this podcast before. I didn't.
You can if you want to. If it feels warranted, Carl, the option is there.
Still kind of in the old RTE mindset of like, oh, I can't say the F word.
I know. I said fuck off, Leo.
Did I'm like, yeah. I was like, oh, I didn't know we could tell people to fuck off. That's gonna change my whole behavior.
I don't do it often, but when I do, I do it with heart. Okay, finally, unfortunately, we need to talk about this is a huge project that was undertaken by, it seems like, am I right in thinking it was like a work across Europe, like a group of journalists across Europe who got together and worked on this?
Yeah, we're talking about rape statistics in Ireland. So this was an investigation undertaken by Noteworthy, which is the investigative arm of the journal.ie. And this was done in conjunction with the European Data Journalism Network. So yeah, it was kind of, it wasn't necessarily journalists from all across Europe, but just that they had kind of access to all this data.
Okay, cool.
From other countries. And yeah, what was discovered is that Ireland has a much higher level of reported rape than most countries in Europe. I think we are sixth in Europe at 34. The number of women reporting rape, and it's not just people, it is female rape victims. So the average number of women reporting rape in Ireland is 34 per 100,000 of the female population, and the average across Europe is 12 per 100,000. So you're looking at almost three times the average. This is something now that this can be attributed maybe to Ireland having a better route for reporting. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have countries in EU where it's, you know, countries have very different laws about rape. Mm-hmm. There's huge kind of discrepancies here. So I think the takeaway, and this was kind of said by Mary McDermott, who's the CEO of Safe Ireland, the takeaway should not necessarily be about, she used a very interesting phrase, shouldn't necessarily be about the pornographic or prevalence details. It should be about just implementing systems whereby we address these, the underlying causes of this, and, you know, have, make sure that we have safe havens for women who are in danger. Very interesting stats that came out of it was, I think it was 78% of women who experience sexual violence, they experience it at the hands of someone they know. And that's something I think that we kind of are well aware of, but it's it's really interesting data, but very, very disturbing and quite shocking, because I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily think of Ireland as a country where this is so prevalent, and maybe that's naivety on my part. I wouldn't have thought that Ireland was one of the worst countries in the world, or in Europe, for this kind of thing. But yeah, it's very, very stark, and it certainly kind of knocked me off my feet. I was I don't know how you felt about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's upsetting, obviously, but I can't say that I was massively surprised. I mean, anecdotally, I know people who work within universities who have seen, you know, a real issue with sexual assault within them. I know people who work within other groups where I'm trying not to identify anyone, where it's relevant, who have come to me and said, like, what can we do about this? And I'm not an expert, you know, I'm just someone who has opinions at the end of the day, but it is really upsetting. I mean, I think it is interesting. Last week, the Met Police came out and spoke about their work regarding violence against women and girls, which obviously isn't just sexual violence. But the head of the Met Police said that essentially it should be treated like terrorism or organized crime. Like, it is that serious, and that it needs to be given the same level of funding and the same attention as organized crime or terrorism. And I think that that's, you know, a really strong stance for the Met to take. And I think that, you know, I kind of feel the same. I think that there's a lot of work to do. And we're seeing improvements in schools and sexual education. And I actually saw yesterday that, I don't know, I don't think people are aware, but Cillian Murphy is like really, has done this really cool work around empathy. I know that's not the big story about Cillian Murphy this week, but we will get into the other stuff in the entertainment section. But he became really interested in empathy kind of when he was raising his two boys, and actually wrote a book about it with a psychological expert. I think it was a psychological expert. Sorry, I'm going to get some of these details wrong, even though I've actually written about this myself. But he then funded the development of an empathy kind of class in schools, which was rolled out in a small number of schools in 2020. And I believe I read this week that it's being rolled out further now. It's going to be packaged into the transition year in lots of schools, which is great, because basically empathy, you know, a lack of empathy is at the root of a lot of the problems that we have around things like sexual violence and violence in general. And all human beings are born with an ability to empathize. In fact, even from being an infant, like if a baby's crying, another baby will start crying. You know, that's empathy. And what happens is, if we are not given empathy throughout the course of our life, we unlearn how to have empathy. But it can be improved with teaching and with the right, you know, the right work. So I feel like I've articulated that badly. But anyway, just another little cool thing about Cillian Murphy, that like he's really passionate about this, and I actually think that kind of stuff really will have an impact. I genuinely do.
I think you articulated that really well, because by the end of it I was like, wow, I'm even more in love with Cillian Murphy than I was 5 minutes ago, and I was already extremely in love with Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, it's just so cool that, you know, like, I think also how cool to kind of see a problem and, you know, want to do something about it, and then also like have the access or the money to actually do something about it, which I think is incredible. But the fact that he's done this, he's been committed to it, he's, you know, as I said, written a book and actually has worked on this program is, truly incredible. He's a great guy, I think.
It's unbelievable, you know, and there's no like sense of patting himself on the back from him either.
No, because,
you
know, loads of people don't even know this.
I'd never heard of this at all.
The only reason that I know is because I was writing an opinion column. Sorry, my brain is ceasing to work. I was writing an opinion column about empathy, and when I was doing my research, I came across this information about him. Yeah, it's very, very cool. Very cool.
But yeah, I do agree. Like, and I kind of, because I've been writing about this for a long time as well, just because, you know, and I feel like I kind of had more to say about it when I was a younger man. Not that I'm you know, old now, but I know when I kind of first started journalism, when I was 22 or 23, coming straight out of college and coming straight out of being kind of more closely exposed to like lad culture and like in 2015 and 2016, back in the day, that there was a lot of conversations about rape culture back then.
Yeah.
And certainly at the time, what I felt, while it's so important, obviously, for the Gardaí to be serious about it, that I really did feel like the education system was where the battle was truly going to be won or lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, like I, you know, went through school without virtually any sexual education, and even beyond sexual education. This is I'm delighted to hear about this empathy thing. You just need to be taught to respect people. You know, it's not even just about sexual education. It's about how you generally perceive people, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's like you need to be taught that people are not something for you to use in any respect. Yeah. You know, that, you know, you need to just people need to be treated as their own autonomous selves, and they need to be respected and they need to be appreciated.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the education system could just do a much better job of kind of teaching kids to be holistic and to sort of appreciate each other and not be in competition with each other, and not be taught that boys and girls are like different, and that like boys are this way and girls are this way, and you need to do this to impress girls. And it's like the whole thing as it stands is very toxic. And this is why it's so sad to see, because I feel like we were making progress. It's very sad to see sort of these TikTok influencers, people like Sneeko and Andrew Tate, who have such a grasp on young men these days.
Yeah.
And I assume this is something you think about a lot as a mother of boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is really frightening. And that's something else that I think we probably will eventually need, like, you know, national policies to address.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it is hate speech. You know, if it just because it's about 50% of the population doesn't mean it's not hate speech.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with every single word that you've said there. And the beauty is that, and look, there will be people who will say, surely parents are teaching their children this at home. And the reality is, not every parent is. Some parents don't have the language themselves. Some parents weren't taught it themselves. Some parents don't have the time. Some parents are working two jobs. Like, let's not vilify parents, but not every parent is in a position to do this kind of stuff. And I know, don't get me wrong, teachers, I can hear you already. I know you are so busy, and I know that you are under-resourced, and I know that you are underpaid. But if there is a way to build this into children's school lives and adolescent school lives, I think we can all agree that there would be massive improvements. You know, because the beauty of it is brain development carries on through adolescence. So, you know, you can get in with first years and second years in secondary school and really help them to learn these skills. So yeah, I would be relatively optimistic about things improving if we invest in programs like that. And yeah, big up Cillian Murphy. What a guy. Okay, Carl, I presume you're going to collapse now. I'm borderline collapsing, but actually I have to talk to Cassie now in 15 minutes about the entertainment.
Oh, wow.
But thank you so much for dragging yourself out of your sick bed. It was important, absolutely. I think, that we do this week.
Straight back into bed
Yeah,
now.
Do. Thank you, Carl.
No problem. Give Cassie my best.
Thanks, bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.